With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial, and with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown, and through adaptable problem-solving, we do just that. Learn more at Marines.com.
It's the wrap-up episode of The Wheelhouse. It's episode number 37. We are inside the Ichiro Room here at Safeco Field. Aaron Goldsmith, of course, Jerry DePoto, Colin O'Keefe running things for us. Jerry, wouldn't you know it, when I pulled into the parking lot about, 30 minutes ago, it's a little after 1 o'clock on Wednesday afternoon, can you guess the one person who drove in right after me? Not a player and not a coach, kind of part of the team, though?
Based on that timeline, I would say that that person would be Ichiro.
Ichiro drove in on a Wednesday afternoon at roughly 1 o'clock, and I had to ask. I didn't ask him, but I had to wonder, A, is he wearing batting gloves while driving his car? And B, is he going right to the cage? Like, is that exactly where he's going right now?
I think both of those things would generally be affirmative. he was here yesterday, and he will be here tomorrow. Ichiro, his work habits are phenomenal, and the most prepared player maybe in history. And we had our organizational party, our end-of-season organizational party yesterday here at Safeco, where everybody around the organization, from ticketing and marketing and sales and baseball operations, et cetera, you know, the field crew, everybody was out there taking batting practice, playing volleyball, tug-of-war. It was a genuine field day. And lo and behold, right about the 1:15, 1:30 mark, Ichiro, the venerable Ichiro, is standing out in right field in some shorts and a t-shirt and the batting gloves and running through some calisthenics and sprint routines with his partners, the guys that are there with him every day. And one of our people from IT, or IS as we call it, you know, the in-house smart people, went out and was working with Ichiro in a moment on throwing a football. Something I'm sure that he didn't do a lot of growing up. And it took all of about, I would say, three throws before Ichiro looked something like Drew Bledsoe.
You know, just spinning it in right
field. Yeah, and just firing it out. And then how I knew that Ichiro was in tune with what was happening in the world of football around him is that he started running pass patterns with various members of the Mariners organization throwing him football passes. And occasionally would catch one as he was stopping short of the outfield fence and then proceeding to do a pseudo touchdown dance in front of the open stands. And I thought he was going to do the Lambeau leap, but he's there every day and he's grinding through it. He is preparing himself for another run on the field and see where it goes. But my suspicion is that whether it's at 45, at 55, or at 65, Ichiro will do this. He just loves the game. He loves preparing. He loves being at the ballpark. And when I asked on Sunday, hey, when will I see you guys again? When he and Alan, his interpreter, were leaving, I said, when will I see you again? They said, oh, we'll be here Tuesday. So Ichiro's off season was all of about one day. And he was here at 1 o'clock on Tuesday hitting in the cage and working out on the field.
Trevor Millis, who works with us right down the hall in the port, our digital graphic designer, one of the biggest fanboys in a front office full of Mariners fanboys. He was one of those people throwing the football to Ichiro. He started in the middle of this season, so not that long ago. And yeah, he's out there in his Griffey jersey throwing the ball around with Ichiro. And it was just one of those absolutely surreal things that, because Ichiro came out and he's like, what's going on? I'm ready to do my normal workout. What is all of this? And lo and behold, it transfers into Ichiro throwing a football around.
Now Jerry, how was O'Keefe in the cage?
Well, I did have to summon the maestro in from the outfield where he was shagging. And what I would say was not the most athletic wear of those who were on the field yesterday. But
the Chukka boots didn't fit in well in the outfield?
I had sneakers on, jeans and sneakers. I wasn't going to do the full shorts workout thing. I was able to do what I needed to do.
He went the cool guy routine, but he came running in his jeans and sneakers and with the hat on, he was in there. He had the ball cap.
How are the oblique doing all right today?
Nothing grabbed. Doing all right. Feeling fine.
It's So I summoned him with the microphone over the PA, and he came in, and at the time I was getting ready to, I was lubing it up to get out there and throw batting practice to a group of people. And I decided in that moment that as my launch from the dock, I wanted to embarrass O'Keefe in the box. So I got him in there, and from 40 feet away, I started throwing as hard as I possibly could. and to his credit, did you happen to watch the one-game playoff between the Milwaukee Brewers and Chicago Cubs?
I saw parts of it, yes.
Did you see the part of it where Daniel Murphy faced Josh Hader?
Sadly, I did not see a Hader pitch.
Have you seen somebody fence before? Like half kind of just poking something out there, not really looking to make a lot of contact, but maybe not get embarrassed. Yeah, that was roughly how it went.
Were you Hader and he was Murphy?
Excellent word picture. Yeah, there's. I will say this, that in the Hader-Murphy category, you're talking about two elite-level major league players who are great at what they do. And it was the first Daniel Murphy, who's about as good at controlling the strike zone and barreling a baseball as any hitter in the big leagues over the last handful of years, looked absolutely overmatched by Josh Hader in the moment. You know, left on left, and he's throwing 99 miles an hour with crazy angles, and you know, Murphy swung at a two-strike pitch roughly as he clipped it out of the catcher's glove and shot it into, you know, the opposite dugout, and almost to the point where you would laugh when it happened. And that felt to me like, I would say, the first 10 swings that the maestro took yesterday in the cage. And then started squaring some up, started timing it. And
really, after all that, there was actually an 11th swing?
I officially struck out until maybe like the fifth or sixth pitch. I mean, it did an ugly swings, a couple balls, and then I tipped a couple, stayed alive, but then I went down.
He was fouling them off. He was grinding in there, and I thought, if nothing else, he had courage when he got in the box. Hey, because
that's saying something.
It was enjoyable. I will. The only way that any ball I put in play was a hit, and I think we had this going, was had a little hit and run on, poke a little bleeder through the right side.
Scott rarely has a hit and run on. It's not very realistic.
That's right.
Rarely seen.
It was, it would have to have been one of those that hit the bag, you know?
Hey, yeah, those are the best.
Ricocheted to the right. Yeah, it does happen.
Pitcher goes off to field it. Second baseman's right behind him. Pitcher dusts it.
Hey, all in a day's work, my friend. Good work, O'Keefe. Nicely done. And you're still in one piece, and you're wearing the same jeans. Also a good thing. Well, this is, we got a lot to kind of to cover here, Jerry, in the final episode before we take a little bit of a hiatus. First of all, other than just completely embarrassing O'Keefe in front of all of his coworkers, have you been able to take at least like an hour just to kind of decompress a little bit from the season now that it's the off season?
No, is the answer to the question. You know, we started Monday morning, got here probably 3 hours earlier than I would on a normal day because I wanted to get a little bit of, you know, kind of gym activity in before our day started. We had a series of meetings that began at 9 a.m. on Monday morning and ran through, I would say, 2:30 in the afternoon. Then we had a media session. Then I had a debrief breakdown with Scott before he left for the day and checked into his decompression mode for a little while. And then yesterday we had our field day where I became one of the de facto bullpen or BP pitchers and took a couple of swings and then went home and grabbed a quick meal and watched what I thought was a terrific game between the Cubs and the Rockies.
Wasn't it great?
It was an unbelievable game. Unbelievable game. That's October baseball. It really is.
Unbelievable. It was, and to have it happen at that venue too kind of adds to it, right? That was just terrific. Our 3.5-year-old son loves watching baseball. We have a rule that he can't. What he normally does when he's watching like the Mariners game is he will, every time a pitch is thrown and somebody swings at it, he will swing his, well, it's a fake bat, of course, and then he'll slide on the living room carpet because he just, actually, I would say sliding is the best part of his game right now.
And can we have him work with Guillermo Heredia? and I say that lovingly.
Yeah,
I love
course,
you.
Of course. Yeah. But we have a rule that he can't slide in his pajamas because he has ripped holes, like vicious holes, in both legs of his PJs. And so last night he was up late watching, at this point, like the eighth inning of that game, and oh my gosh, after I just yelled at him for sliding because I knew he was going to rip his pajamas, the self-discipline that he had to not slide when running around the living room, you could just see. It was like I'm just clipping his wings. So I had to pause it and put him down to bed, and then I enjoyed the final. I guess what? Was it 12 innings, 13 innings?
Yeah, 13 innings.
Yeah. Amazing. Tony Walters, man. I said to my wife, I was like, you know what? This is going to, like, nobody's stringing hits together here. Somebody's just going to pop one. Somebody's going to make a mistake. Nope. Tony Walters.
Three straight two-out singles, which is, with Tony Walters being the one to deliver the deciding blow, was, I think, to me, it reminds me of so many things that we watched in baseball growing up, kids, even through my professional career. The guys that step up and become October heroes that you would otherwise have never heard of. You know, the Ed Armbristers, the Buddy Biancolanas, the Brian Doyles. There's been so many of them through the years. Guys that had, you know, generally otherwise subtle major league careers or contributions, but in October they step up in a moment and they become superstars, and they're Daryl Motley, and they hit huge homers that everybody always remembers.
Well, the subject of our first ever Stump JD, Terrence Gore, with the money bag.
Exactly. Who now has a hit.
I was going to say, I'm very happy for Terrence Gore for coming up.
I did in my sitting there with my wife and my daughter watching the Cubs-Rockies game last night. When Terrence Gore came up to home plate and they flashed up his career stat line.
1 for 17?
Yeah, it was 1 for 17. And, you know, obviously they didn't put the number of bags, but they started talking about the fact that, you know, Terrence Gore with the plate appearances without really having any anything but stolen bases or runs scored. And I said to my daughter, who's pretty in tune with what goes on, although I wouldn't say like a psychotic fan, you know, I turned around and I said, you know what Terrence Gore and I have in common, sweetie? She said, virtually nothing. And I said, other than nothing, we both have one major league hit.
Hey-o! Nicely done.
And I told her the story about Herb Washington and Terrence Gore. And I said, it's going to take somewhere less than two pitches for him to take off and steal second base right now, and he will be safe. And it worked out that way, and it wound up being the big run. And then I sent a text message off to the people who I knew would be most proud of the fact that Terrence Gore had that moment.
Sure. And who would those people be?
There are people from the Kansas City Royals who invested so much time and effort in getting Terrence Gore to the big leagues. But, you know, Terrence Gore, Dave Roberts in 2004, yeah. Terrence Gore in 2014 again last night. These are some of the biggest stolen bases maybe in postseason history. And, you know, he's got two of maybe the top five in that category.
I loved where Verscurgeon was going with it, because after that steal and then the run that scored, when Matt was alluding to, you know, maybe this is one of the great stolen bases in Cubs history. Because, of course, if they win that game and then they go on and they win the World Series.
Oh, right? He's a legend.
It doesn't happen without Terrence Gore. But of course, Herb Washington paved the way. hey, I know you've had a chance to talk to the media on kind of a broader scale with Scott the other day, and I was curious hearing you talk about Scott for a moment ago. What is kind of your normal off season conversation like with Scott? How often do you guys talk? When moves are made? How does that all work?
You know, it's intermittent, as I would say, the clearest way, unless we've got things going on. So, if I get thoughts, if we have general activity, like in this case and in most cases, we will have some staffing to take care of. We will take some time to decompress. So Scott will have a chance to just get away and go spend some time with his family, like any one of the rest of the staff should. And, you know, in about 2 weeks, we'll get back after some of the activity. And that time we will vet for new potential staff members. We will sit and put together an off-season game plan, and at whatever time, and it could be 5 days from now or it could be 10, where Scott's ready to come back up and you know, start swimming again, we will re-engage on where we're headed there. We're planning on a baseball operations leadership retreat, go down to Arizona.
Will there be s'mores at this retreat?
There could be in the evenings around the fire outside, because in Arizona we can do that. We were going to spend a week down in Arizona watching our fall league players and just generally trying to determine the best route to travel for us as a franchise as we move forward, and what the roster might look like more conclusively, and put to bed, or hopefully at that time reconnect a full coaching staff and what that might look like. So it's a time to reflect. And then we will periodically be together, whether we want to or not, the general manager meetings, the winter meetings, and we will do something here in Seattle as a group before we kind of break up and move apart for the holidays. And then through the holidays, I'll talk to Scott a couple times a week, but we'll text most days and generally stay in touch that way. And once we get into open markets and players are now available, trade talks are being discussed, and free agents are starting to rifle in, I'll be on the phone with him, or he'll be here in person just about every day.
Since you alluded to the coaching staff, Mel Stottlemyre Jr., Mariners pitching coach, will not return for next season. That must have been a difficult decision. What goes into a decision like that?
You know, and it is a difficult decision. They always are. Any change you make from the ground root, the grassroots of the organization, ground level on up to the executive level, these are all things we think through. And we've had Mel here for 3 years, and few people work any harder than Mel. He puts a lot into it. And I've known Mel a long time. We worked together for 7 years in Arizona. And I think for where we were in the winter of 2015 and what bridge we wanted to cross, Mel did a great job of helping us across that bridge. But, you know, we did want to focus a little bit more on a process, and we also want to have a larger scale or broader view of how we want to use our coaching staff and each spot on it. And as you know, this past year, we went with a 3-pitching coach model in the efforts to try to make sure that we were incorporating data, we were using biomechanical and traditional methods to work with our players. And I think we need to be aware of what's happening with our hitters, with our fielders, with our catchers, and we need to have some flexibility in our staff and how to fill that. And this is a decision that we'd been discussing for a couple of weeks and ultimately decided was the way that we would go once the season came to a conclusion. He'll land on his feet. He's a good baseball man.
There's no doubt about that. When you look back at the 2018 season, Jerry, you're a win shy of 90 games. If you look at recent American League wildcard history, that is almost guaranteeing you one of those two wildcard spots. This year, different. You can't control what the A's or the Rays do in this particular case. But when you look back to this past season, how do you assess it?
You know, probably more the shame of it is more critically than we probably should. The reality is we probably won more games than we should or than we could have expected to win. I said it during our media session on Monday, our team leaving spring training, if you would have looked at our roster, how we were constructed, and what the bar would have been for expectation, if you would have told us leaving spring training that 89 wins was our outcome, most of us would have raised our hands or clicked our heels, something akin to celebrating, yeah, we're taking that. Knowing that in the 2-wild card format or era, there's only ever been prior to this year 2 teams that won as many as 89 games and didn't make the postseason. And they were both in the same year, the 2012 Tampa Rays and the 2012 Angels, you know, which is roughly to say now that in each of the 4 instances where teams have won 89 or more games and not gotten in, it was twice the Rays and the team that I was with. So, you know, it's a call it bad sequencing or bad luck. But we had a year that was highly productive. We were incredibly entertaining, especially during the first 3 months of the season. The reason we'll look back on it as maybe more sour than sweet is because we did control our own destiny. We had the playoffs within our sights, and we let it slip away. There's really no other way of viewing it. We had it right there, and we didn't need to play 800 ball to win like Oakland did. All we had to do was maintain some level of consistency, and we failed to do that. It didn't help us that the Oakland A's played otherworldly for roughly 2/3 of a season and did what they did. I said it also during our media session, and this is somewhat true, somewhat what I want to believe is true, that it should make us sleep a little easier, that it would have required 98 wins to get in the postseason, which is a really unrealistic target for where our team was. But I'll look back on it maybe once we get to the holidays or sometime over the course of the next couple of years and think, you know, the fact that we as a team generated 89 wins should probably have been celebrated a little bit more than it was in the midst of the disappointment and what we failed to achieve. And that's unfortunate, but it's true. I feel as disappointed as our fan base feels, as our players feel, and as our staff feels. And somewhere we're going to wake up and realize that, we won 89 games with a negative run differential, with a lot of question marks and a flawed roster because we pulled together and we got through it and ultimately came apart at the seams a little bit in the middle and we weren't able to get back on track.
Over the course of 162 games, Jerry, is there a moment in particular that maybe stands out to you as a favorite moment on the field for the Mariners this year?
Favorite moment on the field? I would say the thing that stands out to me most, and I think I've mentioned this before, the Saturday game that we played here against the Boston Red Sox that was started by Wade LeBlanc. It was a twilight start. We were national TV. And at that point, we were kind of cresting as everybody's darling. Contrary to popular belief, we did have a plus 30 something run differential on that day, and we were one of the winningest teams in baseball. We were on track for roughly 110 wins, which seemed a little unlikely. But that day when Wade LeBlanc just absolutely shut down the Red Sox in what I thought was an excellent playoff quality baseball game in front of a full house, and feeling the buzz around town when that all shook out, was my favorite day of this season. And it probably wasn't a single pitch or a single play, but it was that day that I will remember. And when I look back on 2018, the day I remember most.
I remember that day vividly. And my favorite part of that day came immediately after the game. And to tell you what exactly happened, I have to rewind to the day before on Friday. J.P. Morosi, who was a terrific guy and has some Seattle roots and loves Seattle. We love having J.P. in town. He was part of the Fox call that day. And J.P. was at Wade LeBlanc's locker because Wade was starting, of course, on Saturday. And Wade had, at the time, this really big trophy in his locker. And I saw this trophy, and as has been discussed here, I said, Wade, is that the Wade LeBlanc Award? And Wade laughed, and he said, actually, this is from my wife and my two kids in Louisiana. They mailed it to me. It's my Father's Day gift. It's for, like, being the best dad award, right? Well, JP, and I love JP, got it, like, locked in his mind that this Father's Day trophy was just, like, referred to as the Wade LeBlanc Award, which is the, for new listeners, the fictitious award that I invented 2 years ago.
Credit where it's due.
Yeah, when Wade had his first breakout campaign with the Mariners, and it went to the most out-of-nowhere pitcher to help salvage the staff for the rotation for the Mariners. So Wade is, by the way, the only two-time award winner. And when JP did the walk-off interview on national television, right, with Wade LeBlanc, and he talked about how great the day was, and, you know, Wade, who just gives the best quotes, you know, said, you don't normally get standing ovations for guys who throw 86 miles an hour. And Wade was honest against Jerry. Wade was beginning to tear up. Like, he'd never pitched in front of that big of a crowd.
It was a huge day.
Yeah. I mean, the place was jam-packed. It was the most beautiful day of the summer, I think, here in Seattle. And when JP was done asking the baseball questions, he then pivoted and said, again, on national TV, and Wade, finally, I have to ask you about the Wade LeBlanc Award, which was in your locker, given to you by your wife and your two sons in Louisiana. When you put that into perspective, how much even better does a day like this turn out to be? And all I'm thinking as I hear this in my headset is, we did it. We did it. LeBlanc Award has gotten national, baby. Yeah. So I was, for different reasons, that was my favorite day of the year too, Jerry.
Because it celebrated you.
Well, I mean, I don't want to take that approach, but yes, it's absolutely
right. That's
right. and the way, I mean, O'Keefe, the Wade LeBlanc Award, can this trend somehow? Can we hashtag this thing? Is there...
We could get it in, like, the regular awards at the end of the year. That's what we should do. We have the Ken Griffey Jr. Award. We have the Alvin Davis Award. We have all of these awards, and then naturally every year we should just do the Wade LeBlanc Award.
I think that would be fabulous. So we do the Mariners Player of the Year. So MVP this year was Mitch Haniger. Pitcher of the Year this year was Edwin Diaz. And this year's winner of the Wade LeBlanc Award would be Wade.
Yeah, so the only way that he can win it next year is if, like, you trade him someplace ridiculous, right? And then he comes. But even then, I feel like he's too established now. I think it's impossible for him to three-peat the award.
That's right. Now he's a dude.
He's a dude, right?
We would have said that the second time, though. And you can't doubt Wade LeBlanc. I mean, you never know when he might come back for the hat trick of Wade LeBlanc awards.
Love that guy.
I wouldn't put it past him.
If I think, honestly, like a Mariners auction, like I don't even know where this would be a thing, but if somebody could bid on like lunch with Marco and Wade, I think that would get more money than anything else. Those are the two. If you want to talk about a pair to have lunch with, those are the dudes.
It's like having coffee and driving cars with comedians.
Exactly. Those two guys are dynamite together.
Yeah, we did the Reddit AMA with him. I think we were recording this podcast at the time, and Nathan and Jose, a couple members of our digital crew, were doing that with him, and some of the answers out of that were just outstanding. And then, of course, there's always their Instagram comments as well, and I did think it was funny that, because supposedly James Paxton is going to work on learning a changeup from some of the other lefties like Marco and Wade, and on Instagram the other day, so James, I think, commented on Wade's post and basically just said, hey, you know, fantastic James commented first. Wade responded and said, yeah, thanks. You know, it's so great. You know, but don't go throwing way too many changeups on me. And James had to respond back and go, oh, sorry, mister. I struck out 3 on a curveball the other day, though. Wait, James, take a little bit of a Wade stuff.
Which it is, now that you bring up Paxton, it is hard to mention favorite moments of the year without mentioning James Paxton.
The no-hitter. Which I thought was his second best start of the year.
Thank you. Which I feel like a jerk saying that, and I had to like watch how I said that on the air. But
everybody knows.
It's like I don't think everybody knows
he's a jerk, or everybody knows. Because I was going to defend him here. I think he's James. He might be a jerk, but he's our jerk.
Thank you.
Yeah, I love
me
him.
Or James.
James is not a jerk.
I know he's Canadian.
James is really good.
Yeah, he's good. 16. We saw Chris Sale was nasty. I mean, like, you go down the list, right? Like, almost anybody for the Astros, nasty stuff. But, man, when Paxton punched out 16 and nobody had any chance.
Not even foul balls.
Yeah.
It wasn't even foul balls.
It's like one of those things where I've argued with people that Kerry Wood's 20 strikeout game where all he gives up is, what, a swing and bunt single? It's like, that's one of the best starts in baseball history. And some people are like, well, no, it was a perfecto. It wasn't even a no-hitter, so this. It's like, no, he was nasty that day. And that's like with that 16 strikeout game. It was ridiculous.
Like Edwin Jackson, when he started against the Mariners near the very end, I looked up his no-hitter. I mean, like Edwin Jackson.
Oh, I was there for it.
Yeah, of course.
Yep, working for the Diamondbacks with the Tampa.
I mean, like, in Tampa. He has a no-hitter, right? Like, think about all the Hall of Fame pitchers who never threw a no-hitter. He threw 70 pitches through the first 3 innings.
It was 160 some odd pitches for.
He walked 8 batters in a no hitter. Right now, Paxton's no hitter was much more dominant than that. But point is, just because he says no hitter, there can be more dominant starts while giving up a hit. Right.
That is correct.
Not to digress too much.
And if you were going to cut Paxton loose and have him throw 145 pitches. Who knows where that strikeout total ends up?
Sure.
I mean, you're probably looking at 18, 19 minimum.
For sure. He would have, yes. I totally agree. He
was. And frankly, at the 145 pitch mark, I've never actually seen this happen. James, I don't know if you've caught on to this through the time with James. He throws harder and harder as his pitch count starts to creep. And by the time he gets into that 100, 115 range, he's throwing harder than he was in the first 20 pitches. And I don't know what it would look like once he got into 145, maybe something akin to Sid Finch, but it would be phenomenal to watch.
Well, as we look ahead a little bit, Jerry, towards 2019, obviously you've already mapped out. You guys have a lot ahead of you in the coming weeks and months and the entire winter time. But when you talked with the mass media, the group media here at Safeco Field the other day, I mean, you kind of mentioned reassessing to see where the Mariners fit in the marketplace. What exactly did you mean by that?
You know, we do have to take a look at our roster. Understanding, like most teams, we have an element or a number of players on our roster who are starting to age, and we have a number of younger players or less experienced players who are coming into their own. Every roster has a balance to it, and you know the teams that you see generally crest at postseason time have a large group of players who are experiencing their prime years at the same time, and No, you most nights you're going to turn on the TV for the next 4 weeks and see that. See a group of players, usually in their late 20s, that are cresting at the same time, and they're still going to have an exciting veteran player, and they're still going to have a young guy who is taking the world by storm or has some sneaky good skill that you like. You know, we have to look at our roster and determine which categories each of our players fit into, and then determine which core of players you're building around. You know, when I got here in the winter of 2015 or the fall of 2015, you know, we had determined at that point that we were building around a core that existed of Felix Hernandez and Kyle Seager and Robinson Cano and Nelson Cruz. As we flash forward to end of season 2018, I think there's a fair discussion to be had. Has our core started to shift, or has it already shifted? And we've begun those discussions. We have to look at all different possibilities with this roster, because what we're doing now has been just good enough to be the fifth best team in the league over the last 3 years. And our sequencing has been so bad that despite the fact that we are one of only five teams in the American League with a winning record over the last 5 years, there are three teams in back of us who've made a postseason appearance and we haven't. So we have built a team with the idea of getting in that 85, 88 win range year in and year out, believing that that's going to get you to a postseason when it breaks correctly. That just actually hadn't happened for us, because we've been an anomalous team in that a year in which we win 86 or 89, years that typically do get you into a postseason, it hasn't happened for us. I don't think that makes the logic wrong. It makes the result bad. And we have to go back and look at a process that's going to lead us to a more stable result. And, you know, whether that is looking at a status quo, is there an opportunity for us to go out and make acquisitions, either be it in trade or free agency, to augment this roster and help us make up the ground between us and the teams in front of us? We have to talk about the potential of perhaps taking a step back and figuring out where in this market we fit and retooling around a new core group. And then there's the ever-present questions as to whether you tear down. And, you know, the one of those three options that I don't think makes any sense for the Mariners is the tear down. The complete tear down, we have too much talent to tear down. It's when you've got players like James Paxton, like Jean Segura, like Mitch Haniger, Edwin Diaz, Robinson Cano, you have too much talent to tear down. That is senseless. Most teams are trying to figure out how to acquire talent of that level. Our challenge is that we're trying to catch particularly four teams in Cleveland, Houston, the Yankees, and Red Sox who are ahead of us in the standings. And we don't have a two-game gap to make up. As we just saw, we have more like a 10-game gap to make up. And more importantly, with all that talent, we still find ourselves 15, 16 wins above replacement behind that group. And we're in the top six in the American League in that core category as well. So if we're putting solid war teams out there, if we are talented to the extent that we're most years over the last three in the top 3 to 6 teams in a 15-team league, and we're still considerably behind the teams ahead of us, we have to reassess if we're being responsible to this organization and to the idea that we want to build a sustainable, consistent playoff presence. Hopefully that makes sense.
Yes, I think that's what a lot of people probably are asking themselves more, fans that is, right now, now that the season's over with. I think it's so easy for people to say, just tear it down. Tear it down, right? Because it happened in Chicago, it worked. It happened in Houston, it worked, right? Now the Marlins are going through that. But the tear down is not as easy. First of all, it's not a one-size-fits-all, right? Like, not everybody can tear down like other teams can tear down. And you're not guaranteed success with a tear down.
You're really not. And I've been kind of outspoken about that. I also think that there's the marketplace, and I'll use that word, this industry has changed considerably even since the Astros and Cubs went through their rebuilds. And, you know, you could at that time tear down in such a way. And by tear down, I think what you're insinuating is, you know, take it all out, fellas.
Yeah.
the furniture, the appliances, take it all out of the house. We'll sell off whatever isn't nailed down and rebuild from scratch. To do that and the perception that you're doing that through the draft is simply wrong. There is no team that's able to do that, including the teams you just mentioned. The Cubs, for instance, is a great example. It's widely perceived that the Cubs have done this, that had the success that they've experienced over the last 4 or 5 years, which has been phenomenal. A World Series, a trip to the postseason in each of the last 4 seasons, something along those lines. Maybe the greatest run in the last 100 years for the Chicago Cubs. And what I think has cemented a Hall of Fame resume for Theo Epstein, among others. What they did was phenomenal. They didn't build back through the draft. I think they roughly have 4 players of note on their team that came through the draft or signing system. Albert Almora, Chris Bryant, and Kyle Schwarber, and the catcher,
Contreras.
They're the guys. Everybody else was acquired as free agent or a trade. And, you know, that is it's still a teardown. They sent everybody out the back door, started clearing the house. But if you think a teardown is going to result in that type of return, they went from 0 to 100, and they did it by putting one of the top payrolls in baseball out there on the field when it was their time, and by picking in the top 10 in the draft for 3 years. And they hit on 3 guys. And they really traded well, and they really signed free agents, John Lester, Ben Zobrist, Jason Hayward, that affected them in a positive way. Similar with the Cleveland Indians, similar with the Houston Astros. And when this was all happening, and I'll use another example, is the first run of the Tampa Rays when Andrew Friedman was at the wheel. When they rebuilt, they're rebuilding by trading off veteran players or by QOing free agents to get extra draft picks.
A qualifying offer?
Yes, a qualifying offer. And that doesn't happen anymore. You can't compile or amass enough draft picks in that format to make a rebuild happen in that quick a period of time. As a general rule, and this may be a shocking number, as a general rule in a 40-round draft, which is what we exist in today in the amateur system. In a 40-round draft, there's going to be about 30 everyday players that come out of that draft.
30 everyday players?
On average. So think of how long it would take you as an organization if that were your only outlet or avenue. You know, in a true teardown, if what you're doing is tearing down and attempting to put yourself in the top 10 of the draft, you're going to get one of those everyday players more often than not, but they're rarer than you think. They don't come along very often. And the ability to amass multiple of those draft picks in any one period of time is just not possible in the industry anymore since the new CBA came to be in 2012. So what the Astros, what the Cubs, what the former Tampa Rays did, they did at a time when they were able to maximize the potential in the industry around them. And to their credit, they were smart enough to do it while they could, before the next stage came. And you know, I think they've all done remarkable jobs, but to us, the first two of those are options. The third of those, which is teardown, we have no interest in sending all of our talent out the back door. We want to identify which part of this team is the most logical to build around and what our timeline then becomes.
Do you feel like this past season, 2018, that is, did help raise the bar, though, for going forward? It sounds like it must have.
It has to have. And you look at the league around us, when the second wild card team wins 97 games, that's an ominous figure. I mean, 97 games in most seasons is going to be the biggest win total in the league. And you know, what we found out this year was all 97 that would have just garnered us a chance to play a one-game playoff to get the right to go to a postseason series. And I don't think that is insane. We could have predicted this was going to happen in June when we were looking at the way the American League was starting to drift toward the coasts. There were, I believe, 5 teams in the American League this year that lost 95 or more games. There were 3 that won 100 or more games. That's never happened in baseball history. So we were playing in a unique league that was extremely top heavy, and as a result, the teams that were trapped in the middle, and we were one of them, stood out. And I think we had a roughly an 8 or 9 game lead over the next best team in the American League. So it's, I think we do have, we're in a very unique position in the history of the Mariners and in the history of baseball, and with a roster that is still quite competitive and good enough in its best year to qualify for a playoff game. We've just been incapable of putting the right sequencing together.
A few moments ago, you brought up international signing. You have a new director of international scouting. Since the last time we talked, Frankie Thon Jr. has taken over that role. It's a big role, of course, for any ball club. Can you tell us about him?
Yeah, Frankie is a guy I've worked with before. And additionally, Tom Allison, who's our VP of scouting, has worked with before. We worked with Frankie years back when we were in Arizona, his first job in scouting. And Frankie's first 2 years in scouting, he actually had he picked two big leaguers out of when first hired as an area scout. Frankie came from an atypical background. He was a professor. He was working the college ranks, but not as a scout. He was teaching, and
you know what he taught?
I believe it was history, but it might have been psychology.
No, I gotta stop you for a second, because there are people listening to this who want to work in baseball.
Oh yeah,
right,
yeah.
And I feel like every other episode you tell us of somebody that either you've hired or you think very highly of who came from just out of the weeds. I mean, it's remarkable.
Welcome to Frankie Thon.
Yeah. it's amazing.
And in Frankie's case, I wouldn't say while an atypical background for someone hired to get into to become an area scout, he does come from a long baseball heritage. And, you know, Frankie's uncle was an all-star in the big leagues in the 1980s, Dickie Thon. His dad was a longtime minor leaguer coach and then scout who just recently, I believe, stepped away or retired from the game. Frankie's brother played professionally up to, I believe, AAA and as a power hitter. And the Frankie coming into baseball was just him returning to what he had a passion for, but really didn't have the physical ability to do. And you know, his family's background kept him maybe a little bit closer to the surface than maybe someone who normally came from his background, to be fair. But highly intelligent, obviously bilingual, grew up in Puerto Rico, and has, before the Major League Draft ran through Puerto Rico, he was introduced to the talent and how things worked internationally because he watched his uncle, he watched his dad, and that was a real benefit. Frankie, it brings with him experience as an area scout, an international cross-checker, and an assistant in the international department, and I think values some of the more progressive scouting models we're trying to develop now, and which is focusing more on physical traits, athleticism, and the things that we might be able to measure and create specific guidelines as to the play, rather than just simply using the eye test. We've often called the international world the wild, wild west, because you go to the international world, you don't have metrics to lean on. You don't have, there is no data. You're going out and you're watching a 15-year-old kid swing a bat and saying, yes, I want that $3 million. And heretofore, that's kind of been the routine. And I think now in a more sophisticated industry over the last couple of years, especially, and specifically over the, let's call it the last 12 to 24 months, we have seen the measurables that we, things we can do. How high can they jump? Almost like NFL combine type things. How high can they jump? How fast can they run? How long can they throw? What's the exit velocity when they're taking batting practice? Things that we can start to measure. We don't yet know what those things add up to because we're still at the infant stages of gathering some of that data. But I know Frankie believes in a lot of the direction that we're trying to head, both as an industry and we, the Mariners. We're thrilled to have him. We're lucky to have him. Fun story. Frankie, in his first 2 years as an area scout, he had what we called the Ohio Valley area. So he had everything roughly from the upper Midwest, Ohio, Indiana, down to Nashville, Tennessee. And his first year, he landed a second-round draft, which I believe was his first draft pick, was a second-rounder with the Diamondbacks named Mark Krause, who ultimately made it to the big leagues.
I was in the Cape League with Mark Krause.
Oh, he could rake. Krause,
he was,
could rake.
He was an Ohio Bobcat.
That's right. Who and Mark Krause was one of the best collegiate performers in the last decade. Was really, really good in college. And really, really, I mean, terrific through the double-A level and talented enough and enough of a manager of the strike zone to make himself a viable big league player, albeit more of an up-and-down type. And then Frankie's second year, he was in what I think is very subtle and understated. Frankie's not a big table pounder. He's not the guy in the room that's going to yell. But similar to the conversations with Mark Krause, he said, I think I've got a guy. I'd feel pretty comfortable taking him high as maybe the second, third round. And, you know, where's he at? A small school in Ohio. And but I don't think anybody else is really on this guy. But, you know, I really like him. I what do you think he's going to be? Oh, I think he could be an everyday guy. It wouldn't surprise me if he played in an all-star game. And nobody else is on him. You know, our thought is, come on, this was 2010. All right, this is 2010. We've got a guy who's playing real Division I baseball who you think has a chance to go in the top 100 picks in a draft and play every day and perhaps make an all-star team, and you're confident no one else is on him. Yeah, pretty sure. And, okay, we took that guy in the 19th round, and he turned into Adam Eaton. Who became worth about, I'd say, 30 wins above replacement over the course of his career. And on draft day, Frankie's pulse was about as calm as it could be, thinking, I don't think anybody's going to take this guy, but I really like him. And we took him in the 19th round, not because we thought he was going to be an all-star, because, let's just take Frankie's guy. And Frankie was so confident in the player, and we put him out there. And truly, from the minute he stepped on a professional field, it was very clear that, all right, we got a little lucky here, fellas. This guy can really play. And that is a tribute to an area scout's feel and confidence in identifying a player.
Can I ask why no one else was on Adam Eaton?
No earthly idea. No. I really can't give you.
Not a big guy, but.
Yeah, not a big guy. It wasn't screaming with power. But if you look at his collegiate performance, there were things to like about what Adam Eaton was doing on the field, about how he controlled the strike zone. And very quickly, when he entered our farm system that year, he had an edge to him that was different than the other guys. And, you know, I have credit to Frankie for identifying it, credit to Adam Eaton for becoming what I think is a better than good player through the course of his career. And it wound up being a tremendous draft, one of the more understated and high value drafts really in the last 10 years.
Not an all-star though. Do you feel a little misled?
I feel like he whiffed on that one. Yeah. It's a tremendous draft.
I looked him up. He did get some MVP votes a few years ago, but yeah, Eaton's a great player. That's an incredible story. Well, Jerry, as we transition a little bit.
I think it's time for Stump JD.
You know, I have thought about this, and in a Seinfeldian type way. Do you remember the episode of Seinfeld when he was?
Now this is your stump. This is your stump. AG, by the way, is when you
Seinfeld.
Because
It's just not a thing for you. But there was an episode of Seinfeld where Jerry beat a classmate of his in a running race as a high schooler, and it was this person who was clearly faster and a better athlete than Jerry in high school was convinced that Jerry jumped the gun. There was a false gun that started the race. And, you know, and as an adult, this guy was tormented by the fact that Jerry beat him. And Jerry's response in the moment was, we're not going to race. Why? Because I choose not to. He's already been to the top of the mountain. We're getting close to the point where the personal embarrassment that you are making me suffer on a weekly basis is very similar to what the maestro experienced yesterday as I was throwing 47 miles an hour from 30 feet away. And
how does it feel, Jerry? How does it feel?
Empowering. I thought to myself, you know, I was really a strikeout guy as a major league pitcher, but, you know, I think I got the maestro's number here as long as we don't step back to 60 feet.
How many episodes how many seasons, rather, of Seinfeld are there?
Like nine.
Yeah, nine.
So could I like crush every episode during the winter?
And you will laugh hysterically.
I mean, like, okay, first of all, for the record.
Honestly, I'm kind of jealous that you theoretically could do this. Like, Jerry, Imagine you're like, had this in front of you. You have this entire show, nine seasons worth, 20 episodes a season. Never seen it. There's somebody out there who gets to go enjoy nine seasons of Seinfeld.
No, I mean, like, to be fair.
I will say this. There's somebody out there who has the time to watch nine seasons of Seinfeld in the off season.
Yeah. Can't wait for our next remote podcast where in the background you just hear, like, episode 5, season 6. Like, I have seen plenty of Seinfeld episodes. I have not seen a Seinfeld episode in...
It doesn't sound like you've seen plenty.
Like, by my standard, like, I've seen every episode of The Office 5 times. Like, I would watch an episode of The Office for the 8th time without even thinking about watching Seinfeld. But
you're missing out on the better show.
Yeah, I don't want to downsell The Office because I think The Office is tremendous. You're talking about All-Star to Hall of Famer. Yeah, in my opinion.
To each their own. Fair enough. I like Seinfeld, but it's time to embarrass you now. Now, I'm sure that they talked about this during the play-in game. Like, I'm sure they must have. Like, I didn't see every second of that broadcast.
Nor did I, but I saw the good stuff.
But man, what a season for Christian Yelich, right?
Yes.
Gosh, incredible. I remember talking to Blow, by the way, when the Marlins were in town, I guess it was 2 years ago for Interleague. And, you know, they had, like, a lot of really good players on that team.
Super athletic team.
Yeah, I mean, D was there, right? I mean, they had Stanton, of course, who was still, like, he hadn't hit 100 home runs yet, but he was still Giancarlo Stanton. They had Ozuna, right, who was about to really break out. And they had Yelich, who made, if fans remember, he made this incredible face-splattering catch into the fence in center field. I remember when that series was over, I looked at Blow, and I'm like, okay, Blow. And I had my guy in mind, right? I go, you can have any player from the Marlins right now. Like, right now, who do you want? And he's like, oh, Yelich. I'm like, yes! The guy's a stud, right?
Stud.
Total stud. Like, his leg, his, like, waist comes up to, like, his armpits, practically. Like, you can, he's still, like, growing into his body, it seems like. So this concerns Christian Yelich. He fell with the play-in game, so 163 games. He fell a ribby and a dinger shy of the Triple Crown. I mean, if he had hit one home run, he would have had the Triple Crown. Now, Miguel Cabrera was the last Triple Crown winner, right, in 2012. Do you know the last National League Triple Crown winner, Jerry?
Ducky Joe Medwick.
Yes! All right. See, I feel good about this. He's going out on a high note. I would hate for him to go to the holidays.
I feel bad that I don't have the Superman music themed up, because when Jerry comes back, Jerry Seinfeld comes back for the second race, car backfires, that's goes right. off early, Jerry wins the second race, Superman music plays, it's fantastic.
Do it in post, you can figure all this
so
out.
So you brought up the play-in game. So when I described that moment, the Josh Hader, Daniel Murphy moment, where the swing is, let's just call it less than the standard for Daniel Murphy. And I turned around. I was actually sitting at a table eating lunch watching that game with Edgar and Chris Prieto.
Oh, nice.
And I turned around to Edgar after that swing. It's 0-2, and Hader's just – it looks as filthy as anything you'll ever see. I turned around to Edgar and I said, whether or not I would have the opportunity to jump around at the end of this, knowing that we just clinched the National League – division, the National League Central division title and home field throughout, I think after that swing, I would simply just walk off the mound and tip my cap to the crowd and let the next guy take over and finish the game, because I don't know that on the way to the top of Mount Kilimanjaro, you can feel any better about the ascension than you could in that moment when you have that good a hitter and you kind of have that result, which is how I feel right now. I've just thrown Ducky Joe Medwick out there.
Ducky, by the way, 1937 with St. Louis. So the National League has gone since 1937 without a Triple Crown. Let's see, the last six Triple Crown winners have all been in the American League. Teddy Ballgame twice, the Mick once, Frank Robinson, Yaz, and then Cabrera. So think about this. From Yaz to Cabrera, 67 to 2012. I mean, I guess this is not a fairly common thing. Which, when you look at J.D. Martinez and his pursuit of it for as long as he went after it in the summertime, this is a pretty rare thing. Although, I know, not to digress too much, Jerry, but, like, people will poo-poo the RBI, right?
The RBI should not be poo-pooed, to be fair. Like, it may not have the status that it had in 1967.
Sure.
But it's a real thing. It actually does matter to score runs. It's just not the most effective way to measure the way you score runs.
Yeah, like I remember when, so Cruz, in 4 years, Nelly's driven in 100 twice or three times in a Mariners uniform. And I remember looking at his numbers, like for those of you who are Baseball Reference Index subscribers, which is like the best $40 that you could possibly spend. I remember looking up, like I sorted by plate appearances, right? Not at bats. I wanted to, let's include walks here, let's be fair. Look at just the overall basic numbers, runners in scoring position, right? And it was amazing, a hitter like Nelly compared to, I mean, guys like, well, sluggers on other teams that are just raw hitters. You know what I mean? And it's like, it gets to a point where you're saying, I know that you have to have people on base, and you preferably have to have people at second or third base, but just because you have those guys on the pond doesn't mean that the call-up from AAA can drive them in.
100%, because the volume gets turned up from the pitcher's mound too.
Absolutely.
Yes.
I mean, for years, Felix, and it was almost unexplainable, and I'd asked Felix about it, Felix was a better pitcher when he had runners in scoring position than when he didn't. And his answer, which I like, it never made sense to me, but, you know, he was in the total prime. He just said, I feel more calm when I have runners at second or third. Like, it was almost, I can't explain it.
The rest of us are sweating like Robert Hayes in Airplane.
I got him right where I want him, right? But you're right. It is, guess when guys really turn it up the most? You can't have, like, Christopher Negron's a great guy. Like, Christopher Negron's not going to drive in 100, right?
Seems unlikely, but sign me up if you'd like to try. Yeah.
So the RBI has been poo-pooed in recent years, and I get it, but I'm with you. It's still a skill set.
And maybe as much as it is a skill set, and it might not be as high on the status meter in the fan world, in the maybe more sabermetrically inclined universe we're living in today, it still is very much a status symbol among the players themselves. Mm. The players themselves, I would venture to guess, if you took 250 major league players, offensive players, and asked them, what is the single most important statistic? That might be the one that you come away with as the one that they define as the most important, driving in the runs.
Interesting. We got some listener questions here. This is got a couple of fun ones. Jane would like to know, do you have a go-to off-season baseball movie, and what would be the accompanying food?
Oh, the accompanying food will always change based on the moment. Tonight, that accompanying food. We are going to try something new tonight. I'm going to make a traditional steak Diane.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
All right.
Give that a rip.
That's a big league dinner right there on a Wednesday night.
Yeah, which will be followed by Yankees A's. But the go-to movie will always be The Natural. It's the greatest.
No matter what time of year it is.
No matter the time of year. Although I will say, once we get around the start of spring training, I will watch almost any baseball movie because now I'm getting the itch and mm-hmm. I want to go. But to me, The Natural it's like perfect filmmaking. The acting is off the charts good. The storyline is awesome. I feel like I could act out every, you know, line in the movie because I've seen it so many times.
When he answered the Stump Shitty question, right? Can you underlay like the natural music with that? Like whenever he gets it right, that should be the victorious sound. I think that would be good for everybody. Mainly for Jerry.
No.
We could do that. What baseball team has that, like when they score
Rangers
a run?
Have
that's
it.
Right. That's right.
Yeah.
It doesn't appeal to me very much when the Rangers do it.
Yeah.
To be fair.
Like to me it's kinda like if you hit a home run in the eighth inning, not that the Rangers are down 10-0, but if you hit a solo home run in the eighth inning down 10-0 and you play the natural song, it's kinda like I mean, like, let's save it for moments.
I love The Natural. I love, particularly once you get into the fall months. Mm-hmm. Because it's not like a super bright movie. It's a fairly dark movie. Yeah, you know, it's just the tones of the
right.
of the filming. You know, cinematography. But the when you get into the fall months, it is some kind of to me relaxing to watch it. I actually watched the Natural. It came out. I think maybe my senior year in high school, summer of my junior year in high school, in that transition, and I had a VHS player, and I took a copy of the actually it was a beta.
Nice, there you
I took
go.
A copy.
It had a great run, beta.
It did for both years that it was in existence. I had a homemade copy of The Natural that I poached off of HBO when it was playing on HBO, and I took that home copy of The Natural off to college with me, and it put me to sleep roughly for my first 2 years in college. Every night I would turn it on until I fell asleep at roughly the same time in the movie.
You know, our son, our 3.5-year-old, saw The Sandlot for the first time when we played it on Mariners Vision after a game here at the ballpark earlier this summer. And I think this offseason, I think it's going to be time for Sandlot at our house in the living room, some homemade popcorn, like not the microwave, but like on the stove, like with
the actual, real stuff.
The real stuff. And there are a few things he likes more than baseball and popcorn. So I don't think we can go wrong with that. We'll be working our way up to The Natural.
You can get it. And I will say, the other one that I would throw in there, if you just want a good laugh, mm-hmm. that is timeless and maybe among the most accurate depictions among baseball in Hollywood, was Bull Durham.
For sure.
Bull Durham is actually quite lifelike. I mean, most of that does happen year in and year out. And I, up to and including the people that were in that movie, who are some are no longer with us. But we are going to go through a Nuke LaLoosh-type media training session with some of our players next year. So if you have nominees, let me know, and we're going to teach them how to go through that.
Eric would like to know, with all of the emphasis these days, of course, on the advanced metrics, the exit velocity, the spin rate, and whatnot, as the general manager of a ball club, how do you measure the things that you cannot measure, right? The character, the ability to, kind of what we were just talking about with hitting runners in scoring position, the ability to be clutch, right? These things that you cannot put on a spreadsheet. How do you go about doing that?
You only know when you know. And I've said this about scouts. The only scout that you know is a great evaluator is the guy you worked with. It's not a guy that you're working opposite. Sometimes you just might pick the right guy because you got lucky. Sometimes you might pick the right guy because it's where you landed in the draft. The same can be said of players. You think this guy has intangible traits that really separate him from the others until you have him on your club and you realize, he's no different than the other guys. There are a number of players that you will run across and that I've had the privilege of either playing with, working with, having on different clubs that I've been with that have those intangible traits, and you can smell it. You can smell it when they're an A-ball. You know it when they get to the big leagues. There are character traits that, frankly, without going into it too deep, one of the things we're trying to figure out how to better measure is how to identify those traits when we sit down and we're interviewing teenagers or draft eligible players for the next draft, so that we don't have to wait until they're in our system and we can have a pretty good idea that this young player has the traits we're looking for. I stop short of saying we will do psychological profiles, but we do. and we want to be more aware of how to introduce that player, because so many of them, I'll cite this, and I know he's a no-brainer Hall of Famer and he had one of the great careers in baseball history, but for so many years I heard the criticisms of Derek Jeter when compared to Nomar Garciaparra, when compared to Miguel Tejada, when compared to Alex Rodriguez. There is a leadership gene and he has it. There is the guy that could elevate his game and become what the others couldn't. He has it. There's a guy that can keep the area calm when there's chaos happening around him, and he could do that. And you could see it with Derek from the time he got to the big leagues. And he was one player that you're watching from the other side almost jealously. Like, how do we get more guys like that? And it's never going to show up on a spreadsheet. It's never going to make some sense to someone who is purely clinical or lacks context in their decision making. But it does exist. Those intangibles make a huge difference. I wish there was a way that I could tell you we measure them. We're trying, but we're still very imperfect in that area.
Did I ever tell you my Jeter interview gaffe? Did I tell you
no.
this? So this is his farewell season, right? And he's coming through Safeco Field to play the Mariners. And so I'm like, I gotta get Jeter, right? So I clear it through their PR guy. We get the whole thing set up, and we're asking about it's like, how do you interview a guy who you just summed up in Derek Jeter? How do you talk to him for 4 minutes and cover it all? Right? It's impossible. And so one of the things I asked him about is he made his major league debut against the Mariners at the Kingdom. So the Mariners, I don't know where they got this from, like what storage closet this is in. They got a pair of seats from the Kingdom, and they gave them to Jeter.
I have one in my office. I got it from Randy Adamek. No.
So, and as you remember, and the same thing happened to Rivera, the same thing happened to Ortiz, right? The ceremonial goodbyes at every ballpark. And I think they had just come, they had interleague like in San Diego before they came to Seattle, and Jeter got a like a full-size like surfboard.
Oh, that was from the Angels.
That was from the Angels?
I was there. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I did not hand it to him, okay. But we provided
So he's getting like support. All these things, right? And we're not talking like watches. I mean, we're talking like you need to ship this. And we're like, we're wrapping up the interview, and I kind of wanted to end on a lighthearted thing. And I said, you know, Derek, Mariners give you a pair of seats from the Kingdom. The Angels, you know, give you a surfboard. So-and-so gave you this colossal thing. Derek, you even have room for these? Yeah. I got room.
And, that's well, right.
As soon as I said that question and I like looked in his eyes and he kind of gave me this look before he said anything, I was like, God, come on, man.
That's right. Come
on. Yeah, he's got AG, all the room on. He ever wants. He's got more than enough room. There's he needs room. More room, he can get more room. Not this is the least of his worries is where am I going to put this?
That's right.
Yeah. So that was my infamous Derek Jeter run-in. Well, as we wrap this one up, Jerry... Man, you know, this was born out of an idea by O'Keefe. Am I right here, Colin?
We're actually in this room. I think I kicked it to Kevin Martinez in this room, this podcast. And I was like, you know what we should do? Let's have a podcast with our GM. Reward some of the diehards who are listening. Kevin lobbied for it. He made it happen. And yeah, now here we are.
Now, the story that I've been told, Jerry, is basically after Kevin got wind of this idea from O'Keefe, he strolled down to your office, knocked on your door, said, Jerry, how about the idea of doing a podcast? And you said... Yeah, great. Just let me know when. I mean, is that like basically like the cliff notes of this?
Absolutely. And then I negotiated the multi-million dollar contract well, for that sure. was associated with this broadcast. No. I think this has been a blast. And credit to the maestro for putting sure. it together and for keeping us on point for 37 episodes. You know, it's not easy, although it seems so. It's not easy to be the maestro.
And to plug everything in the correct ports. Every time.
That's right. Most Send of the us time. The calendar yeah. invites.
Right. And not having yep. us be 10 minutes in and saying, cut. Start. We got to start over. I don't think that's happened at all this year, O'Keefe.
No, it's been a while.
Yeah. So first of all, Colin, thank you to you for helping to wrangle this whole thing together for almost 40 episodes. And Jerry, there's not a single general manager, not just in baseball, but I mean, back me up on this, Colin. There's not a single GM in any sport.
Though, because Jerry's done so well with it, and you guys have as well, that may not last super long. I even came up with another meeting today. It's just one of the fun things for our fans, and you guys have crushed it. And I would say before too long, we'll see more people doing it. But, you know, thanks to everybody who's listening. It's fun. One of my favorite things with the podcast is it's wild to look up where people listen. So, of course, people listen in the United States, and they listen to cities all over the country. But of cities with like more than 15 listeners, or countries with more than 15 listeners, you're looking Canada, Australia, the United Kingdom. We had 125 downloads in the last 30 days from Japan, New Zealand, Republic of Korea, France, Sweden. So it's pretty crazy how far this thing reaches. And we see it in emails, we see it in numbers. So it's been a lot of fun to do. I mean, general housekeeping, we will take a short break, be back probably around the GM meetings once activity starts picking up. And hopefully we'll have a live show for fans.
At some point in the season. We talked about that a little bit. Yeah, nice.
But yeah.
But I kind of envision like a college game day environment for that. Are we on the same page for the live show?
We'll try.
Okay, yeah. Maybe the Cougar flag can show up.
Can I be Kirk Herbstreit? Yeah. I don't want to be Lee Corso.
I'm not putting on the moose head for one.
Okay.
That'll be enough. You, Aaron.
Yeah, I'm the hair, but whatever. Jerry, thank you for all the time, man. I mean, you've given us, think about it, like almost, probably close to like 40 hours almost of content. Behind the curtain, behind the scenes, a lot of humor, a lot of good food. I'm excited for, can we call it year two of the Wheelhouse?
Yeah, year two, season two. It'll be a blast.
Okay. Yeah.
I'm in.
All righty. Thanks, Jerry. It's been a lot of fun.
You got it. Thanks, guys.